The following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio, brought to you in part by Recovery Centers of America, the nationally recognized leader in drug and alcohol treatment, using proven evidence-based treatment, including 24/7 medically supervised detox, inpatient and outpatient options. You'll receive exceptional care from an expert team of master-level clinicians, physicians, nurses, and staff using 12-step methodology and medications. Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region. A proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825. And Acadia Healthcare, with locations on the East Coast. Acadia maintains a standard for excellence in the treatment of behavioral health and addiction concerns. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. Mark, what is new this week in recovery news?
We have some sad news. Danielle Bowker of Toms River, New Jersey, was taken into custody for two counts of vehicular homicide from a car accident March 29th. Blood was drawn. Results came back that she was in no condition to drive, due to a level of 61 nanograms of THC in her system at the time of the crash. She surrendered. She's in custody. This is what we were worried about.
Yeah. Well, car accidents. You know, it's a familiar story, isn't it?
It is. And it's one of our big worries with pot going legal. More drivers out on the road intoxicated.
Yeah, absolutely. What else do you have?
We've got another depressing story. An underage man from Tawako has been indicted by Ocean County Grand Jury for a crash resulting in death. He was charged with vehicular homicide, and he was out driving his boat on June 13th, 2021, and he had been consuming alcohol. He had a passenger. He hit a cement block at night about 1 in the morning, and his passenger flew out of the boat and drowned. And so this guy, you know, was also indicted and taken into custody this week.
You know, there's such a fine line between an accident and a criminal charge. You know, if you're intoxicated, it's a whole different story. Then if this – either one of these things happened, they would be accidents if they had nothing in them.
Well, and either one of these could have happened anyway, right? I mean, somebody could have just gotten in a car accident, but they happened to be – you know, under the influence of something, and you automatically are done, you know, vehicular homicide and things. So there's a lot of people out on the road, they're driving around high and they think it's no problem. But if they were to get in just a normal accident, they're in big trouble.
And I think people don't realize if you're in a boat, it's the same thing as if you're in a car.
It is. And I'll tell you, from being a guy that owned a Grady White at one point, we were almost killed by a speedboat late at night, driving back from fishing, and I have no doubt they had to be intoxicated.
All right, did you hear this one? New York Times announced today that 12 Americans die. I mean, get this, 12 Americans die every single hour of an overdose. So if you do the math, that correlates to over 105,000 people a year, and that's a low number because these are the reported incidences of overdose only.
It's so tragic. And you know, what we're seeing is that they're younger and younger. A lot of these are young adults that are taken out in the prime of their life due to fentanyl many times.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, good stories. Thanks for that. Hey, listen, we're going to take our first break. And then when we come back, we're going to be speaking with a mother and her son who were both in heavy addictions. And now they're doing incredible things and helping and giving back. So it shows we do get better. We absolutely do and can get better, and we'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
If you're struggling with alcohol or drugs, Recovery Centers of America can help. RCA's local inpatient and outpatient programs are founded on science and delivered with heart from an expert, caring team who will inspire and guide you every step of the way. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now to speak with a treatment advisor. At RCA, you'll be in a community that builds connections and fosters support from peers and RCA's team of medical professionals and recovery support specialists. At RCA's state-of-the-art campuses in Devon, PA and Mays Landing, New Jersey, they tailor your treatment to you and also offer specialized programs for patients with history of trauma, for patients who have achieved recovery but are experiencing a relapse, for young adults, adults 50 years and older, a confidential program for first responders and military, and a faith-based program. RCA answers the phone and accepts patients 24/7. And because it's local and in-network with insurance providers, treatment is affordable and accessible. Don't wait. Call 1-888-RECOVERY. Recovery today.
Hey, this is Bob Forrest, and this is Clean and Sober Radio. I work with Dr. Drew. I'm sober, I'm crazy, and I love this show.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
We're also heard on these great radio stations across America. WKDWN, Las Vegas, Nevada, WHFS, Tampa, Florida, and WGAC, Augusta, Georgia. Before we start the show, I just want to make an announcement. You know, if you want to listen and watch us do the show every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, go to Facebook and to our webpage, cleanandsoberradio.com. Just like these folks, Judge Andrea Duffy, Debbie Reynolds, Laura Story, Bob Moeller, Frank Griffin, Nancy Minnick, Dennis Hannon, and we'll get to everybody else later on the show. So we're going to start our show. Guys, we are so happy. Linda is here, the mom, and her son Ben is here. And both of these folks were in addiction. And this should be an incredibly interesting story. So, guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Gary.
Good to have you back. I mean, Linda, you're almost
a regular
on here.
Yeah.
And you brought your son Ben. And Ben, tell us a little bit about you.
It's hard. I don't really like talking about myself. Lord knows.
Well, this is a good time to talk about yourself.
Exactly. Lord knows why I came on the radio. I'm 30 years old. I've been sober almost 13 years.
Wow.
I got sober when I was 18. I think I lasted about 3 months after my 18th birthday. It took me very hard and very fast. I started using when I was 10.
And 10?
10.
With what?
Inhalants.
Oh.
Inhalants. I have a friend of mine who I kind of did a lot of my stuff with.
Yeah.
We two peas in a pod. I hate to put blame on anybody, but the DARE program taught us, like, these are all the different things you can do. And, you know, God rest the man that that was my DARE officer. He was also in the program, and he became a friend later in life. But, when I was 10 years old, he taught me that, like, you could put paint in a bag and just do it, and it would give you a funny feeling. And, you know, I was I'm an only child, and I had recently experienced loss for the first time. You know, I'd lost my grandfather when I was 10, and he was a very important person to me. And I didn't know what to do with those feelings. And you know, as much as I can remember, that was something, you know, these people told me, like, you can feel this way if you do this thing. And from that moment forward, it was just a constant stream for the next 8 years of my young life. Like, how do I find this? Because I remember one of the first times I like blacked out. Like, I'd done too much of it, and I fully was gone. Oof. And I loved that feeling. That was the feeling that I sought. I think a lot of addicts, alcoholics, like, there's lots of different feelings that they seek. You know, I've met lots of different people and heard so many different stories over the years. I am an oblivion person. I want to run right up to that edge of, like, I'm either not here or I'm asleep. And that's, you know,
so your addiction was, you weren't even an adult. So when you say 7 years, 10 years old, you know, did you ever wonder, hey, wait a minute, maybe I was really too. Maybe I'm not really an addict because.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, maybe it was a phase. Mm-hmm. You know, look, I even think of that about myself. So, Linda, when your son was going through this, did you know it was going? He was 10 years old.
No, and I had over 20 years in sobriety at that time.
Uh huh.
And well, later when he was like 13, I had 20 years. And one of the counselors called me into elementary school when he was in fourth grade.
And he, well, fourth grade would be what, about
grade,
10 years old?
10, 11 years old.
Yeah.
And she told me confidentially, like not on his record, that he was sniffing white out and he was stealing it from all the different teachers' classrooms. And I told her, you can't believe the thing words I used to her. I told her she was lying, yeah. She was wrong.
Of course.
I was in high denial from the beginning. I had no idea what he was doing.
You were in high denial
high
while
denial.
Your son was in high,
right.
Not denial.
And it's so scary because those inhalants can be devastating.
Yeah.
I mean, devastating. And parents don't realize this. And, you know, if you start – one of the things that you should pay attention to if you smell any kind of weird chemicals around your child. But again, you think 10 years old, there's no way. Right? Mm-hmm. And so you would go, what, into the garage and get paint?
Into the garage, get paint, paint thinners, even gasoline, you know, yeah. If you have, running a snowblower or anything like that that requires a little bit of gasoline. Same kind of thing. You just need, you know, I don't want to teach anybody how to do it on the air, but like it's a very simple process. And like it was just that elusive feeling of, being high.
You know, it's amazing. Somebody's listening to us and going, wait, what? But yeah. They don't understand the addiction is so powerful.
It is.
That you can't rationalize any of this.
No.
You know
absolutely
how,
not.
Who would snort, who would sniff or paint thinner?
White out.
Office supplies, computer duster. Like,
yeah.
There's any number of different things.
Oh,
and
yeah.
it graduated. And I think, you know, mainly because both of my parents at that point in my life were sober and in a program of recovery, you know, there's no booze in my house. There's no booze. There's no drugs in my house. There was nothing for me to seek within the home. You know, other friends of mine, you know, we would go to somebody's house and like raid the wine cellar. You know, we live in an affluent place. Like, you know, you could go and get these things. But like I knew – even at that age, I knew that stuff wasn't in my house. So I reached to what I could get, and then it just became an evolution of, like, what can I get my hands on, you know, as a teenager, of, like, where can I get money? Can I get money from them? Can I steal money? Can I sell something? Can I do any kind of way to get money to get a thing? Like,
Linda, when did you start to believe the teacher and know that he was in trouble?
Later on in high school, he was in trouble, but he wasn't in trouble for using. He was in trouble for some other stuff. And then when he was 14, he was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis.
Oh, okay.
So I was able to get him some accommodations at school, like to get him the elevator key and a few other things. And so he was kind of singled out by the aides and the teachers and the students. Like, oh, you're not on crutches. You don't have a cast on. You didn't break your leg. Why are you in the elevator? So he had to explain invisible illness to these people who were being rude to him. Hmm. And this went on and on. So I thought he was acting out because of that.
Right.
I didn't think he was using. A couple of times, once we had to pick him up at a party in Jenkintown, he was wasted. And then once his friends brought him home and they handed him to me and he just like fell in a hump. But, like, that was twice partying that I knew about. So I thought, oh, it's not so bad. He's just trying it. I didn't think he was doing it every day until he went to college.
Right. If you're just joining us now, we're speaking with Linda, the mother, and Ben, her son. They were both in addictions at different times, but they still lived in the same house. And it's interesting stuff. Let me ask you something. So he was – Ben, do you remember your mother being high? Or you were too young, or he, or Linda, were you out of it before he was born?
Yeah, Joe and I met in the program.
Okay.
So we met in the program. We got married. Ben came along when we were together 5 or 6 years. We got married.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
And so he never saw us.
You never saw. Right.
Until later on.
I mean,
until my operation when I got hooked on the pills.
You know, my question was going to be, was there any influence in your house on why you started using, but apparently not.
No, I think there was good influence. There was good influence. I remember, you know, finding I'm a book nerd. Now I'm an English teacher, you know, later in life. So like my parents had books all over the place. And I remember finding recovery texts.
Yeah.
When I was very young, and the one that stood out to me, because it was worded so simply, was the beginning of the NA text, the section, who was an addict. And I remember reading that at 13, out of my mind. But I was like, this makes sense. Like, I had good influence in my home. And when I ended up going to treatment, you know, they wanted to send me to Florida. They wanted to send me, you know, go to this place. I was like, no. I have two sober parents at home. I want to go home. Like, I want to go to a meeting. I want to start my life again. You know, I wanted a different shot. So, like, I don't think there was any kind of bad influence at home. Like, you know, I think I get it from – I think it's inborn. There was something in me, you know, because I've met other people that are my age, you know, other kids that, you know, that I went to college with, and I've seen them use heavily. You know, I was in a fraternity. I was sober as a bird in my fraternity, but like I saw people doing cocaine off of the table and drinking and all that. They don't have a problem. They don't have a problem. They graduated college and put that stuff down and they've never touched it again.
Well, that's the difference between an addict and somebody who's an addict.
That's what I'm saying.
Linda, I'm watching you as your son is speaking with an incredibly large grin on your face. And you must be incredibly proud. And you must be incredibly proud of your mother and your father.
Absolutely. And especially understanding it later.
It really helped him that he was surrounded by AA people from the day he was born.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I took him to a meeting when he was in his carrier, in the baby carrier. I took him to St. Asaph. So, I mean.
There's the meeting up the street. I remember, you know, I was a little kid and she would bring me in early and
I would make
she
the had coffee. The key.
She would make the coffee way early before the meeting in the percolator and I would help set up the chairs. I was like 9.
You know, we're all lucky around here. My kids never saw me high.
Right?
Mark, your son never saw you high. That's pretty incredible.
We're really lucky. And then when Ben went to college, which I was going to say, he went to college and I didn't hear from him for a few weeks. I went down to visit him. He was weird. He wanted to meet me in a diner. He didn't let me go to his room. And then 2 weeks later, he called and said he was very sick and he was going to go to the urgent care. And he went to the urgent care and he didn't get better. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. They thought it was the H1N1 flu back then.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear from him for 24 hours. I called someone at the school, and she went and did a bed check, and he had 105 fever.
Oh, my gosh.
He had an infection that was unbelievable. He went back to the hospital in Annapolis, and they told him, you have to have an endoscopy. So then he started crying and said, I want to come home to have it. So we went and picked him up with the truck, and we brought him home. And because he was 18, he had just turned 18, the doctor couldn't tell me what was wrong.
Right.
He told me after. A handle a day of vodka the whole time he was gone for 6 weeks.
So it's detoxing.
Fully. So no, he burned his esophagus out 11 inches. Mm-hmm. He almost had Barrett's esophagus. He almost
had cancer
from it.
Yeah,
he was home.
I was drinking.
Swallow for six months.
Drinking unstoppably, and just in the I think it was 5 weeks that I was away at college in Maryland. Like from the moment they dropped me off, as soon as they disappeared out of the parking lot, I think I was high in 5 minutes. And it just didn't stop the entire time. And the only thing that stopped me was physically my body couldn't take it. And when we got home, this man, this GI doctor, he didn't believe me. I was sitting in his office, 18 years old. He's been a doctor for almost 30 years. And he looks at me and I'm like, no, I was drinking half a gallon of vodka, 30 beers a day and doing enough pills to down an elephant. And he looks at me like I'm insane. And I'm like, no, that's the tolerance that I had built up. And then he put the camera down my throat and he saw almost the entire length of my esophagus was an ulcer. And when I was in the recovery room, he was like, I believe you.
Yeah.
I believe you. And I still didn't get help.
These doctors. We got an email this week from Leslie V. from Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. What kind of doctor should I reach out to in order to get treatment for my daughter's addiction? Lady, I think you're better off calling the mental health hotline and the drug abuse hotline at 1-800-662-HELP because unfortunately, you know, a very large percent of these doctors have no idea about addiction or where to send you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's getting a little better, yeah, thank God. Bit. The you know, they're doing more schooling in medical school, yeah. And but yeah, definitely get somebody with experience, you know, that has experience with addictions. This is insane because usually the thing people don't realize a lot of times is alcohol can actually burn through your throat and you can bleed out.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you don't see this in an 18-year-old kid. 2 months of I mean, you must have just been
nonstop.
It's unbelievable. I've never heard of that before, like, at that age.
You know, it's that drive. Gary was talking about it. There's a difference in addicts, alcoholics, people who use like I do. Like there's an unstoppable drive, and the only thing that gets in its way is something that's like beyond. Like,
I mean, the only people that can understand what you're just saying are addicts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like you need air to breathe. You need dope. You need drugs, mm-hmm, to, mm-hmm, keep going. At least that's what we thought.
100%.
And run from feelings, right? Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm, absolutely, Mark.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mary Lou from Dayton, Ohio asked us, extreme risk protection orders, the red flag laws that they're trying to pass for gun control, mm-hmm. Can someone's medical records from a rehab be considered to reject a person's purchase of a weapon even though they're clean and sober?
Not in Pennsylvania. This is my specialty, is the law.
Tell us about that.
Intersecting with alcoholism and drugs.
Tell us about
it. In Pennsylvania, we have the strictest in the country law for privacy of records for mental health and alcohol and drugs, even one step higher. And we take classes every year, counselors, to make sure that we know the latest law and the ethics and everything. So I'm not sure about Ohio, but here it can't – here you would never – that record would never be without a double consent. They'd have to ask your consent a second time for that specific thing, fax you or email you a thing, and you'd have to sign over that you were releasing it. And even then, a lot of counselors won't release it without a subpoena.
Really?
I have never – other than a defense attorney where I get a double thing.
Yeah.
For a client, I don't reveal anything. If a client comes in, is doing really, really well, and they want a letter for the judge, they're going back to court, they're going in for a little hearing, I'll say they attend every week. I don't talk anything about what they say, no diagnosis, that they're attending the program, they're doing the best they can, and that kind of stuff. But the records, I've never seen anybody release records.
That's good
without
information.
A subpoena.
That's good information.
And even with a subpoena, you don't say too much.
Well, and you don't even have to release them with a subpoena unless it's a court order by a judge, which never happens.
Exactly. So we really don't – nobody could find that out in this state.
Ben, you know, you're talking about all the stuff you ingested. Mm-hmm. I know it was too long ago, but Laura Story says that last year she knew of three people who died from hand sanitizer. Oh my God. You ever hear that one?
Absolutely. I'm a teacher. I've spent the last couple of years teaching. It's crazy what you see. I saw a child, a fifth grader, who was interested in drinking it. And he tried to sneak it on me while I was watching him in class.
You were the wrong person to sneak it on.
I was the wrong person to sneak it on. I have an eyeball for it. I have an eyeball for kids like me. And I see him go over to we had the big jug industrial hand sanitizers at the school. And he grabs a cup and he like pumps real quick into it. And he leans out the door. And he's got it behind the door. And he's like, oh, can I go to the bathroom? And I was like, not with that in your hand.
Absolutely.
Let's get back here.
And we have to take our second break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Linda the mom, Ben the son. And if you want to join this conversation, give us a call at 1-888-329-3306. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
Don't let addiction rob you of one more day. Pocono Mountain Recovery Center offers comprehensive addiction treatment for adults. Depending on your unique needs, your care at Pocono Mountain may include detox, residential treatment, and an array of outpatient options. We also offer transitional living support and transportation for outpatient participants. Pocono Mountain is in network with most major insurance plans. Start your recovery journey at Pocono Mountain Recovery Center. To learn more, call 877-596-0223.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
And We are back. You know that drop from Judy Collins? I remember when she was on the show here, and we were talking, and I said, boy, we would have been great friends in 1968. You know what she said to me, Mark?
I heard.
No, we wouldn't.
That was cool.
Well, you must have rubbed her the right way, huh?
Right?
Were you here then?
I can't remember. You told me this story last week.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I did?
Yes.
That's
when we were smoking cigars out front.
Yeah, that's incredible. So, okay, so your story, guys, is, you know, it's not unique, but it's an amazing story, you know, that you both had addictions. Listen, you had on both sides, Ben, of your family, and that you've come out of it to do really great stuff, and that's what we do. Mm-hmm. We definitely can do that. Yeah. You know, first, I always say this, you get clean, then you get sober, which your brain starts to rewire, and then you give back. Mm-hmm. And that's what you guys do.
Yeah. I mean, it's important. It's an everyday thing. You know, I got into the program like right away, and I've found over the years it's the best way to keep myself sober is to talk with, deal with, help, you know, especially other addicts and alcoholics. But it could just be anybody. Just get outside of yourself and do something good. You know, when I was out in my addiction, like, I wasn't helping anybody. I was doing absolutely nothing good for the world that I existed in. And now, you know, getting to live the life that I've been given, you know, giving back is everything.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. You know, I was just thinking that, you know, I went through this with my kid. You know, yeah. It's heart-wrenching. It's horrible. Linda, how did you deal with a kid who was in severe trouble?
It was so hard. It was so hard.
It's all-encompassing, right? I mean,
it's all-encompassing. It's every minute. And, you know, you go through it with your spouse. We're both sober.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really felt I lost him. I almost lost him. We were petrified. You know, we went to the family counseling at the rehab and everything. And then he came out and started right away with the meetings. And he still has friends that he made that, you know, his friend is 1 year more than him. Hmm. John, 2 years?
No. 6 months.
Okay.
Six.
So they're both going to be 13 years sober.
So one and done.
Which is amazing, right?
That's one and done.
That's me.
Yeah, that's you.
Yeah,
right.
A lot of my friends don't have that story, but I definitely do.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, did this get between you and Joe, your husband?
When he came home from rehab,
he
was very antsy. And Joe was mad. Joe was, you know, he deals with things different than me. And mm-hmm. he was unhappy. He was, you know, I wanted to be better now. I wanted to be better right now. I want to go back to where we were right now. So we took a road trip. We went in the car and we went to Florida. And we did those daily meetings down in Delray. That Delray Clubhouse.
Oh, yeah.
We hung out there for like 10 days. We went to 2-3 meetings a day.
Wow.
That's awesome.
We visited my family too, but we really went down there to go to meetings every mm-hmm. day in Florida. And we went to a meeting, an outdoor meeting in Delray where it was all bikers.
Yeah, that
we
was
went
fun.
To so many cool meetings down there. We met so many people. And then over the years going to Florida, we saw the same people over and over again. But that was really worthwhile. But my cousin lent me her apartment. And they're like normal people. So he was just a week out of rehab or 2 weeks. They had a house filled with liquor. I had to go in and cover it up, put it in blankets, put it in boxes, take it out of the pantry. It was crazy. But we had to do stuff like that. We had to do little road trips and stuff to get through it. And then he had a great sponsor.
Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of great people.
Yeah, a lot of great
that
sponsors.
Helped me.
You know, Bob Mueller reports here that the only way to help yourself is to help others, meaning giving back. Mm-hmm. And that's so true.
100%. Yeah, I was up last night. I left my home group meeting last night, and you know, there's a young woman who's been coming around, and she's been struggling with a lot of stuff. And you know, I saw her disappear. You know, when it was parking lot time, you know, hang out in the parking lot, she disappeared. You know, make a point to reach out to that person. You know,
sure.
And she checked in with me later. And like, it's those little tiny things, you know, it just one conversation can help keep somebody. I remember there was one night that I was going absolutely out of my mind. I you know, sober, you know, a couple months or whatever it was. And I was out of my mind. I was losing it. and it must have been 11:30 at night. And she took me over to one of the clubhouses and just dropped me off out front. We'd called the landline phone inside the clubhouse and someone picked up. And these guys stayed with me until 3-4 o'clock in the morning. You know, taught me to play pinochle, spades.
Nice.
And just hung out with me.
I said, I can't help you.
Yeah. And these fellas took care of me, brought me home
at like 4 o'clock
in the morning. And, you know, they were there to have a social time. Everybody else knew each other. They were there, you know, locking up after a meeting, having a good time with each other. And here comes this little 18-year-old kid who's shaking, scared out of his mind. They stopped what they were doing and took care of me.
Nice.
You know, it's important. And I always say when I talk to people, my first sponsor, I didn't have a license, you know, when I got clean. And she'll tell you, this man came to our house every day for about 18 months.
And picked me up and took me to a meeting.
This is a man with two kids, a wife, a family.
A professional job
and was in, you know, local government. He had a lot of stuff to do. And he went out of his way to pick up an 18-year-old kid.
Every day
and take him somewhere to help him. I can't ever repay that. So it's my – like it's like a duty.
Ben, your success is probably paying him.
Exactly.
You know.
And that's what I see nowadays with my friends. I'm almost verklempt. I'm emotional right now because
explain what that means.
What
for you're overcome with emotions.
Overcome with emotions. Yeah. The Yiddish mother coming out of me. You know, last night a friend of mine who has been struggling for years. He has been struggling and struggling and struggling. He finally celebrated a year last night for the first time in 6 years. It's so beautiful to see that, and all those late nights, the times in the hospital with him, and like all these different things, to see that success means everything to me. And I like to think that my success would mean that to somebody else. It just keeps paying itself forward, you know.
You know, I keep thinking as you're speaking, you're 30. What?
I'm 30.
30.
I'll be 31 in a couple months.
All right, you're 30. Mark, can you imagine at 17 or 18 getting sober? I could never.
No.
I had too much stuff to take.
Yeah, and what amazes me, what I've run into with especially the young people, is the level of denial, right, where it takes years and years to work through that. And so it is amazing. You see every once in a while, you know, somebody's able to get through that denial like you did at a young age.
Because you bring it up a good amount of times. The brain is not totally matured until, what, 27, 28, right. Something mm-hmm. like that, Linda?
Yep.
Yeah.
So for you, Ben, to be able to pull this off is pretty amazing.
And that's one of the things, unfortunately, that we're seeing so many deaths with the young people with the fentanyl is because we don't have time for them to get through that denial, you know, with fentanyl out there. And so what was it like? What I'm always curious about is I'm picturing, you know, 17 or 18 and, you know, friends are all out partying. And, you know how when you're in it, you're like, I remember getting clean and being like, my life is over. Like, what am I going to do with myself now? How did you get through that? And like, what kind of hobbies and stuff did you start getting into?
I think that's a great question. And it's one of those things that, again, I agree with you. I see in a lot of young people that come in, they're like, what the hell do I do with myself now?
Yeah.
You know, for me, it was finding the few other young people in my area. You know, I met some amazing people that were, you know, students in the area, you know, that had just kind of ended up in the same kind of places that I ended up. And one of my old sponsors put it, find your tribe. Find mm-hmm. a few people, you know. I remember the first couple guys I got hooked up with, big into the cigars, like Gary. And we would go sit in the Wooden Indian. We would go sit in the Wooden Indian until 3 o'clock in the morning.
Where's the Wooden Indian?
It's in Havertown.
Okay.
And they have a great
Nelson
cigar lounge.
Nelson used to go there, right? Nelson
used to go there.
Nelson, who is that?
my friend now, Kurt used to go there.
Just so we don't localize this to our viewers and listeners, Havertown is a suburb of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, sorry. Okay, no problem. I forget we're in so many places.
No problem.
And the Indian, is this like some like Indian statue up on a hill?
Yes. Yes.
Is it really?
Yeah. And it's a great place, yeah, but really. it was finding people that had similar interests. You know, I loved cigars. I found people that like that. I have very nerdy interests. I like comic books and board games and card games and, you know, finding other people who were into those kinds of things. And, you know, it takes time. It takes effort. And it takes, you know, being open and honest, which I think sometimes is a little easier for young people because, like, they don't have too much clouding them. That where they're just like, this is who I think I am. and, you know, it was like spending any and all amount of time with people because I was so isolated in my addiction.
Yeah, we bring up isolation.
All the isolation is the new addiction.
So isolated. Yeah. I was a sit in the corner by myself kind of person. You know, I liked to drink and do all those things on my own. And so fighting that by coming in to a program and working on getting sober was finding other people. You know, I'm very fortunate, you know, the young man that I started using with when I was 10, he's clean and sober. He's the one that has 6 months more than me. So like I have my best friend in the whole world. Like, you know, we've been in this together for the last 13 years. Not everybody's that fortunate.
Can I tell him a funny story about that?
Sure.
When the friend was 15, he had gone to Karen, and his parents were told it would be better if you send him to a residential high school. So they sent him out to, was it Iowa or Idaho?
Idaho.
Idaho.
He'll be mad at you for getting that wrong. He still hates it.
Oh, God. He still hates it. But anyway, the day we got a call from his mother, and the mother said, today's the day we're going to be in the airport. We're going to send this person away. And he asked for Ben to come to the airport, the only friend he asked for. So I pulled him out of school, and we go to the airport. And it was this big dramatic thing that the kid was going to be away all year. And we're all hugging and kissing. Years later, I say something to him about it. Neither of them remembered.
No, John, he remembered.
You didn't remember.
He remembered. I was roasted.
But you were toasted, right?
I was toasted the entire time, and I had no idea. And he said to you, we were having a conversation with his family, and they were talking about this like a big, you know, emotional moment of someone's life. And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't remember being there. I don't remember any part of this. I'm sorry.
Hey, if you're just joining us now, it's a fascinating story, guys. We're talking to Linda and Ben, her son, about their addictions in the same house, although different times, in the same house, and how they got clean and sober. And the story is a great one. And, you know, again, Linda, I'm watching you ear to ear smiling because you're so proud of your son, and the same as he looks back on you.
You know? It's so cool. I'm wondering what it was like for you, Linda, to all of a sudden have a buddy in your son to go to meetings with all the way back then. That must have been cool.
Yeah.
It was very funny. I remember the first time she asked me to speak at a meeting, and I'm fairly certain you were there at the old Thursday.
Yeah.
And, you know, she introduces herself. And everybody says, hi, Linda. And I'm sitting right next to her and I say, hi, Mom. And somebody in the first row started laughing and thought that was the funniest thing in the world. But that was just, you know, I've gone to meetings with her. I've gone to meetings with my dad. And, like, I always do that because it's just like it's an identifier to me. And I'm very proud that my parents, you know, do this thing. And stay sober, and that they got sober. You know, I wouldn't even be here if they hadn't gotten sober. Right. Like they met in the program, you know. So it's important to like the essence of who I am. I showed up here because they decided to get sober and stick with this. And like I'm in the condition that I am today because I was able to go home. You know, the day that I told my mom I had a problem and, like, asked for help you know, she wasn't like this, but she had gone in my room. She smelled something and she found some stuff and she called me, and I was at a friend's house, and there was something about that day, and I just gave up. And I came home and I told her, I was like, I have a problem with drugs and alcohol and I don't know what to do. You know, I'm very fortunate that I have two people at home that understood what that meant. You know, I remember my dad kind of giggling at me, you know, when I told him. He was like, I know. Let's go and get you some help. And that's, to me, one of the most important things is, like, to be ready. And this is what I tell people, you know, I've had, you know, my home group in the program is fairly well known in our area, that a lot of young people go to my meeting. And we have parents come all the time that aren't in the program, that have just heard through, you know, the grapevine. And they ask us, you know, and now I'm like 30 years old. I'm not really one of the kids anymore. But they ask us, they're like, what do I do with my son? What do I do with my daughter?
I would tell them to go to Al-Anon.
I do. Yeah. I always tell them. I always tell them I know a few of those meetings and where they're at. I direct them directly to those meetings. But I tell them one of the most important things is be ready, because if they ask you for help, that's your opening. Because if they're not asking for help – good luck. But if they're asking for help, be ready to take them somewhere. Be ready to, you know, open your arms to them, you know, and give them the help that they need.
You know, for our listeners and viewers, if you're watching or listening to this story, it's so important to understand that there is help out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just by telling your story – I'm sure it's giving people – you know, we don't know who's watching or listening. We just don't know. If one person hears a story that has a son or has a mother or a father or a sister and a brother, and they hear this story, and it's – you know, you guys are – you know, have gone through it. It's not like you read about it in a book and this is what to do. You've gone through it, so you have total credibility. And again, there's the help out there. There's no delivery service. There's no – what's the other thing we say? Drive-through?
No drive-through.
But there is help, man.
And you know what's really important, which I'm hearing in your story, is it sometimes I think kids are so worried, like, my parents are going to be ashamed of me. My mm-hmm. parents are going to judge me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not hearing that here. I'm hearing that you were able to reach out for help in an environment where it was like there was no shame.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, that's another thing that I've told those parents and all this kind of stuff, like, this isn't a moral failing mm-hmm. on your child. It's not a moral failing on me. You know, there are things that I did because I was an addict and an alcoholic that might have something to do with moral failing at the time. But the fact that I have an addiction is not a moral failing. There's nothing to be ashamed of. It's a medical issue.
You know, that's good that you could overcome that, because I think most of us have felt, you know, I'm less than. Mm-hmm. Look at me. My friends are doing
years.
This. I can't, you know. So that's pretty incredible.
It took years of work and talking to people to be able to say that out loud to you today, that there's no shame in being an addict. And there really isn't. No. But, like, I would say to anybody, and I see this all the time, I think we all do, when people are newly sober, there's a lot of that shame. And they want to beat the crap out of themselves for it. And, like, you know, I try to provide anything I can to make them comfortable and say, like, it's okay. There's hope.
Yeah,
you can move past
this. And when
they
finally ask you, like, the day that he said that to me, he was desperate. He mm-hmm. was desperate to go right then. We did a 2 a.m. overnight intake in that place in Pennsylvania. So they took him that morning at 7 mm-hmm. in the morning.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
Amazing.
Now, let's do this. Let's take our third break. Listen, give us a call if you want to talk to these guys. Don't be a chicken, everybody. 1-888-329-3306. And we'll be right back with Linda and Ben, mother and son.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care, backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF now. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
What's happening? Brandon Novak here from Those Movies Jack Zor, author of that addiction memoir, Dream Seller. Do me a favor and tune into Clean and Sober Radio with Gary Hendler.
888-329-3306. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
You know, that drop was by a guy named Brandon Novak.
The man.
The man from what the show is called, Jackass.
Yeah, and he's been on many times.
So this guy is clean beyond.
We know about that show.
Clean and sober. He opened up sobriety homes, recovery houses.
Novak House.
He's amazing. You know that?
I didn't know Novak got sober. That's that's fantastic.
Been sober for years.
But Mark,
that's awesome.
Who was the guy on the show that left rehab recently?
Who left rehab?
Bam or something?
Oh, Bam.
Did you have Bam on the show?
Bam
Margera,
he's
a mess.
We didn't have
Bam's
him on the show.
A mess.
She just said.
We didn't have him on the show.
Oh, I know. You just said, who was the guy on the show?
He wasn't on the show. We talk about it. Bam is not.
Who knows? Okay. Listen.
Shark Week's coming up.
it is,
huh? Oh,
yeah. It is.
Got to talk about that.
I wonder if people. Listen. We can't have an inside joke here. I wonder who else, what are you afraid of now that you weren't afraid of when you were getting high? For me, it's sharks and airplanes and open water.
So let me ask you this. When you were getting high, were you not afraid of sharks at that point?
I didn't think about it.
I can't even picture it.
You're too young, 1975, when Jaws came out.
Oh, yeah.
But did you go in the water before that?
Oh, absolutely.
Now he doesn't go in the water.
Oh, come on.
He doesn't.
You're like my fiance. I can't with this. I'm an ocean person. I will swim out. I love it. Just float there. I won't go in a lake though. I'm terrified of a lake.
Snapper turtles.
Like I don't like lakes. I'll go a mile out in the ocean.
Oh, they bite your
don't put
towel.
Me in a lake. Don't put me in
Listen,
a lake.
The Jersey Shore. I belong to a pier there and they catch on a daily basis 4, 5, and 6 foot brown sharks.
Oh yeah.
That are 100 yards from the sand.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Harmless.
So let us know, what are you afraid of now that you weren't afraid of when you were using? Or what's the other part of this? What's the opposite of do you do now that you wouldn't do when you were getting high?
Yeah, give us a call, 888-329-3306.
Linda, what would you tell us?
I was never afraid of anything. I don't know. Heights, I guess. Heights would be the thing.
You still afraid of heights?
Little bit. We were in Las Vegas many years ago, and Ben went off the – what was the name
of that
hotel?
It was the Stratosphere.
The Stratosphere.
The Stratosphere Hotel.
And you
can
go off the top on a bar on a thing with seats way out over the roof.
Oh, no. It was a roller coaster.
I couldn't even watch him do
it. A roller coaster car on a track. And then the track extends about 45 feet off the side of this hotel.
Off the roof.
And then all of a sudden it just goes like this. Crack. And it points down at the ground. And I sat up front and I remember vividly these two young girls behind me screeching. And I'm shocked. Like, you're looking down at the Las Vegas Strip hundreds of feet in the air. And I'm having a ball. I love stuff like that. But these two girls were having the worst day of their life.
Hey, Ben, we got a lot of people watching, okay?
Yeah.
So Nancy Minnick wants me to ask you, do you have a girlfriend?
I do. I have a fiance. We have been dating nearly 10 years.
You can't pull the trigger? Is that what it is?
No. I asked her to marry me in 2020. The main thing that's –
I thought he was going
to
say like 2011.
No.
When he was 14.
The main thing that's stopping that from happening is just – you know, money and time and COVID. Like, COVID messed things up. You know, I want to have a nice ceremony with people and all these different things. And it's like, I don't want people to have to wear masks or do any of that stuff.
Sober.
I'd like to
mess up anything.
Yeah,
right?
and my fiance is sober. You know, when we met, she wasn't. We met working. We met working at a restaurant not too far from here. And she had moved from another state. You know, she was living her life and doing this kind of thing. And she tells me all the time, she had never met people around her age that were sober. And I went to a party with her one night, you know, after a restaurant shift. If anybody doesn't know about working in the service industry, it's full of alcoholics. And, you know, we go to a house party. I'm fine. But she kept offering me drinks. She was like, have a drink. And I, no. And I took her out the next morning for breakfast. And I explained to her, like, very candidly, I was like, look, I really like you. You seem like a great person, but don't do that ever again. It made me really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I don't drink. I'm sober, and I explained to her my whole story. And, you know, over time, I introduced her to more and more of my sober friends, and it took her a little bit of time to realize, and she was like, oh, my God, I identify with these people too much. And she started to examine her own behavior and her own drinking. And I saw it a little bit here and there when we started living together. You know, she ended up getting sober a couple years into us dating.
Wow. So Bob Sherman is watching. And Linda Stern Adoria is watching. And Keith Hornung is watching. And Kathy Wolf Collin is watching. And I want to know from any one of those people I just mentioned – are they doing stuff now that they wouldn't do when they were getting high? And, yeah, the thing – Bob Mueller writes, this is – I was afraid of heights, went on a camping whitewater rafting trip with a club out of Westchester, Pennsylvania. And I bungee jumped off the New River Bridge where that is.
Wow. I'm not doing that. Are
Bob, you? Yep.
Is he crazy?
He's
what?
Crazy.
Nuts.
Could you imagine if – you and I went bungee jumping?
No.
Well, that
you can, right? Yeah.
I can't.
Freaking rope would break.
Right.
You know?
Mine too. I'd bungee be petrified.
Bungee jumping. I'm going to tell you, my three nephews all bungee jumped at the same time off of Victoria Falls in Africa, and my sister watched it.
Wow.
Oh, man. I'll tell you.
That's wild.
That's wild.
Clean and Sober Radio bungee jumping trip.
Yeah, exactly. So wait. So, Mark, let me ask you. Are you afraid of – what are you afraid of?
I'm afraid of drugs, and I was not afraid of drugs at all.
Good
I would
answer.
You know, they would. Mm-hmm. Somebody would be like, try this, and I was like, sure, you know.
Well, now you don't know what's in
it. Oh, anything. My gosh.
I was talking
terrified.
I was talking to somebody about this not too long ago. You know, I think that's an important point to make for people that are sober now. Like, the stuff you're getting on the street, you have no idea. I genuinely, and this is really sad to recount out loud, but like, I can't tell you how many of my friends, people, like we're talking in 30 or 40 people in the last 13 years that have gone out, grabbed some kind of street drug, and it was mostly fentanyl, and they're not here one time. Like, I'm terrified of that. Absolutely terrified. But, using. Catch me in the middle of the street. I'll get whatever the heck you got.
I remember when he was in NA and he had two sponsors and went all the time, went to the meetings all the time and everything. One day he woke up. He was supposed to go to a funeral. And he said, oh, wake me up at 8 or whatever. I'm going to this funeral tomorrow. And I woke him up and he said, I'm done going to funerals.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sick of it. It was like two a week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what
it
happened.
Was like,
and that was 10 years ago.
That was 10 years ago. Now it's worse.
That was 10 years ago. It's even worse now.
Linda, do you have any recommendations or advice for parents who have children in distress addictions? What they should look for and what should they do?
Please go to Al-Anon and Ar-Anon. Please go see people that are just like you, that have been in the same boat. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as a one-size-fits-all. Nobody's going to tell you tough love anymore. Nobody's going to tell you have to throw your kid out. Nobody's going to tell you what to do. They're in the same boat as you. And surprisingly, a lot of people whose kids have passed away run these meetings and go to them. And it's just beautiful, the people that they help. And that's where you're going to get the help on how to live through it, how a parent can live through it.
And you're saying, we're not alone.
We're not alone.
Yeah, that's meetings, you know, any kind of meeting.
Any
shows
kind of meeting.
We're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Connection is the solution. Connection with people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a a half-brother in Minneapolis, and I know they're not listening, but one of their sons, who's 42, was having an issue, and the mother refuses to go down. He talked to us for 5 hours about it on our vacation recently, and we said, you have to get her to go to Al-Anon. You have to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't, if you're all alone
trying
to help somebody.
But you can't force somebody, Lynn. You know?
Right, you can't. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for the parents because they feel like they don't have a problem. Why do they have to go to a meeting? Why can't he just go to rehab once and it's done and it doesn't work?
It's worse for the parents than the actual addict.
Yes.
I mean, because they're doing their thing, but the parents are, most of them don't have resources. They don't, their hands are tied. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible condition that we have going, you know? Mm-hmm. Guys, thank you so very much for doing this show.
Of course. Anytime.
It's a pleasure. Great story, right, Mark?
Oh, you guys were great and just really, really did a great job on this. Telling your story and everything was just amazing.
Before we leave, I just want to mention, because I hate not to mention certain, you know, people that are watching. Rob McGregor and Laura O'Neill Hopewood are watching. And if you guys, if we didn't get to your names, Mark or I, we're sorry. Michael Shoemaker. We'll get to you, obviously, next week. So remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Please call 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about this broadcast, please join us on our mission at cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com.
Say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
Everybody is a star. Who will rain and shake the dust?